Hello, this is Larry Clark from Excelsi Music Publishing, and here is another episode of From the Composer. I'm excited today to talk to composer Steven Rosenhaus. Hi, Steven. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Larry?
I'm great. We're excited to talk to you this morning about your background and a little bit about your compositions and composition process. So I'm excited to hear from you. So if you could start by telling us just a little bit about your background and how you got started to in being a composer and various other things that you do in music.
All right, it's a little hard to get into it because I've had a very long, weird, and checkered career.
Sure.
I started out basically as a folkie. My first instrument was guitar, and I was into folk music and. To make a very long story short, I've done things like I've sung on the sloop Clearwater with Pete Seeger. I was supposed to be in Harry Chapin's backup band, but I turned it down to go to college.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Like I said, long, weird, and checkered.
Yeah.
Once I got into college, I earned a bachelor's in music ed with a specialty in vocal music. I got that from Queens College. And I went back to Queens College for my master's in composition. By then, I was full out composing and really wanted to pursue that. Also got my PhD some years later at New York University in composition and theory. And I've been teaching there, teaching composition there since the middle of my studies there.
Wow.
You want to know, what else do you want to know? You want to know
How did you get started in actually composing? Is that something that happened at an early age or something you grew into?
In its earliest forms and its most raw forms, yes, at a very early age. I received my first guitar for my bar mitzvah. My parents asked me, what do I want for my 13th birthday? And I said, I want a guitar. Because mm-hmm. I had fallen in love with the music of the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel were popular. And I just was immersed in all of that. So guitar was my first love, and you know, music has always been my main focus. So almost as soon as I started playing the guitar, I started writing really terrible parodies of songs. You know, Alan Sherman was popular back then. So I started by writing parodies, and then I started writing my own songs. And performing them and things like that.
Uh-huh. So you started out as Weird Al Yankovic, I guess.
Yes, but I only played accordion for 1 year.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay.
By the time I got to high school, I decided I should play an orchestral instrument. So they were offering lessons at our public high school in violin. And we had an orchestra. So I picked up the violin then. I was not very good, but I got to sit. I was apparently good enough to sit first chair in the second violin section, which was wonderful for me because this way I got to hear everything around me, not just playing the melody. I got to hear the inner parts. I got to hear how harmony works, and that interested me. In fact, the very first thing I ever wrote for string orchestra was an arrangement of a Beatles tune. For that orchestra, and we got to play it down. We never did it in concert because it wasn't that great, but it was my first attempt at it, and it was so much fun doing it. That was one more link in that chain in getting me started. Mm-hmm. Lastly, again in high school, they offered a course in music theory, and I decided to take that as well as an elective. So I did, and one day the teacher, I'll never forget him, Alex J. I came into the class one day and Mr. J was playing The Rite of Spring on one of those old phonographs with the speaker in the cover.
Right.
And it was turned out to be Pierre Boulez conducting a French orchestra, an old nonsense recording, beautiful recording. And it was the first time I had really heard the piece. And I walked into the classroom and there's this bassoon solo hanging on that first high C. And I said, "What is that?" And Mr. J just said, "Shut up and listen." So I did. And I'm listening and I'm listening. And in the meantime, all of my fellow students in this class were, you know, coming into the classroom and talking, and I was totally oblivious to that. I was just listening to this music, and he picked up the needle, because this, we're talking records
right
at this point. He picked up the needle, stopped the music, and he said, "So what do you think?" And I just looked at him and I said, "I want to do that." And he said, "Good, now sit down and shut up." But that was it. That was the point where I knew I had to compose.
Right.
And I realized at that moment that it would be not even a calling. It's a biological function as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I find that most composers, that's the same. I get the same story. They have to do it.
Yeah. And I prefer to do it in a way that's compensated, but I do it.
We all have to pay bills.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. So talk about a little bit about sort of your output. What types of things have you had the good fortune to write, and what sorts of things are out there and available that directors and conductors would like to know about?
I've written for just about every genre, every combination you can think of, with some exceptions. I don't write jazz because I have far too much respect for jazz musicians to do that. Although there are some aspects of jazz that creep into my music from time to time. And so far, I have not written an opera. I have written for dance. I have written for theater, a lot for theater.
Right.
And, of course, I write for orchestra. I write for string orchestra. I write for band. I write solo music. I write chamber music, chorus, vocal solo music. As I said, just about anything you can think of.
Now, obviously, we're talking today about your music that's more, I guess you'd say, for the educational market, for the for students. So tell us a little bit about music that people listening that are interested in that would know of your music, and pieces that you think are some of your most popular out there in that area, either band or orchestra. Doesn't really matter. Or anything else, for that matter, that's too broad.
It's too broad a question. Can you narrow it down, please?
Well, maybe tell us a little bit about some of your output, that pieces you're excited about that you've written recently.
Okay, well, there's the piece that Excelsior is publishing, Danza de mi Corazon, which I wrote for a friend of mine, Gregory Woodbridge, who conducts, or at least had conducted, I'm not sure if he's still doing it, the Hershey Middle School Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
In Pennsylvania. And right. Gregory and I met at the Conductors Institute down in South Carolina, run by Donald Portnoy, back in 1995, I think it was. And we've stayed in touch over the years, and we haven't worked together in the same room over the years, but we have done some projects together on and off. So I wanted to write this piece for his group. And I wanted to write a piece that expressed joy in a different way.
Right.
And literally the title, Danza de mi Corazon, translates as Dance of My Heart. And it is literally that. It's my expression of joy in music. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll get into more details on that specific piece. What are some other pieces that you're excited about that either you're working on now or have completed in the last year or so?
Well, one thing I'm in the process of working on is a work, I'm saying about a grade three for strings with harp.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard a lot of people complaining, what do I do with my harpist? I don't have enough material that they can actually play with our ensemble. Yes. So I took that question to heart and I decided, okay, I'll write something for that. It's a wonderful challenge. I enjoy writing for harp. Yeah. Not many people get to do that. I've done it. In fact, I once had a commission from a very well-known harpist, Emily Mitchell, who had commissioned me to write a piece for four harps.
Wow.
It's difficult enough writing for one. Writing for four is a total mind bender. So I wrote a piece called For the Gypsy in My Soul. And you have to think of it as a giant flamenco guitar to hear it.
Oh, wow.
There are lots of, you know, little special effects and things like that. And it's a lot of fun. And it gets played a lot. Anyway, so recently I've had the good fortune to write a piece in two versions at the same time. It's called JFK, A Profile. Mm-hmm. And it's for narrator and band or narrator and orchestra. And I literally wrote both versions simultaneously, which was a huge undertaking. It took me almost 2 years to write the piece. And it was to honor John F. Kennedy's 100th birthday in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it has been performed in both versions so far, three times each. The first band performance was by the Virginia Grand Military Band with Laura Schissel conducting.
Oh, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the first orchestral performance was done by the Carson City Symphony in Nevada. David Bugley is the conductor and music director, but I got to lead that premiere. So that was amazing.
That's awesome.
And the narration is about 90% John F. Kennedy speech excerpts. And it gives us a clue as to who the man was. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed working on that. And I think it's very effective. And what I like about it is that it's playable by any community orchestra, any college orchestra, certainly, or a band we're talking as well.
Right.
And even a really good high school can do it. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a really nice work, and especially the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
People certainly would enjoy that, I'm sure.
The other things that I've written most recently, I had a commission from another friend of mine, again, somebody I met at Conductors Institute, a fellow named Keith Johnston. He's the band director up at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. And he and I have worked a lot over the years. I wrote a trombone and band concerto for him called 9 Feet of Brass. If there are two things I'm probably known for besides my music, it's having a very odd sense of humor and coming up with some good titles for my works.
Sure.
One piece I wrote for him last year was a piece for dancers called Compassion. And it uses the same instrumentation as Stravinsky's L'Histoire de Soldat. That was an interesting challenge, just using that instrumentation and getting different sounds from it.
Right.
Let's see, what else have I written lately? Folk Song Suite Number 2 is the most recent piece. A few years ago, I did Folk Song Suite Number 1. I called it Number 1 knowing I would come back to that format. And what it is, in each case, it's three movements, and they're all original tunes written in Celtic music styles. Mm. So the new one, Folk Song Suite Number 2, there's a jig called The Lucky One. There's an air called Some Sunday Soon. And the third movement is called Fisher Cut Bait. And that's a reel. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of richness to obviously the folk songs of Celtic folk songs. And mm-hmm. I've done similar sorts of things where I've written in the style of, I guess, because mm-hmm. it's just a beautiful examples of, ways you can write things and do things.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that I'm drawing on the Celtic influences to write these original tunes, I come by honestly, I think, because I started out as a folk musician doing traditional music of right. America and the England, Ireland, and Scotland.
Right.
So I'm very familiar with all of that.
Excellent. So talk to us a little bit about your compositional process. What do you, have a certain way of doing things?
Oh, no. I don't have a certain way. I have many ways of working. It depends on all sorts of factors. Am I writing it for myself? Is somebody commissioning it?
Right.
Many years ago, I got to meet Sammy Kahn. Lyricist who wrote Three Coins in the Fountain and High Hopes and a few other well-known songs, mostly sung by Frank Sinatra.
Right.
And he and I were talking about things, and I said, what question do you get asked the most? And I'll eliminate all of his profanities, but he basically said the question he gets the most is, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And I said, so what's your answer? He says, the phone call.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the answer.
Right.
And sometimes, like the folk song Suite Number 2, I decided I wanted to write that. And actually the JFK piece as well, that I turned into a consortium commission. In which a bunch of ensembles contributed a smaller amount than they would normally to commission the work, and they each got a local premiere.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the process goes, if somebody contacts me and says, I want a piece for four harps, or as has happened, I once got a commission to write a concerto for lute.
Yeah,
That's not something I would have thought of to do on my own,
right?
Ever, but mm-hmm. But it was a challenge, and it sounded interesting, so I did it, and it worked out. So the process begins with who's initiating the composition in the first place.
Right.
Then, questions come up like, how much time do I have to do it? I once had received a commission from someone to write a short piece for two clarinets and bassoon. And the commission came from a friend, but it was a real commission. And he said, I want you to write this piece. I'm taking it on tour with my trio. And I said, fine. Now, he called me on a Thursday. You can hear what's coming. I said, when do you need it? He said, well, we leave on Tuesday.
Wow.
And I will eliminate my own profanities from that conversation and tell you that, yes, I wound up writing it. And I knew he was going to be playing the second clarinet part. The name of the piece is called Breathless. You can imagine what I did to him in the second clarinet part. I challenged him on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it depends. I don't have a daily schedule. I carve out time as I can, as I want to, as I need to. It all depends on the situation. I don't even write every single day. There are times I can go for a week. Nowadays, I can go for a week without writing. But by the end of that week, I get itchy.
Right.
I need to sit at a piano, or I need to sit at my guitar, or I need to sit at the computer, or just with a piece of paper in front of me and just start writing.
Is it something where once you get started on a piece, do you stick with that one, or do you shift back and forth between different projects?
I tend to be single focused when it comes to writing music.
Yeah, me as well.
I have done it where I've worked on more than one piece at a time. And I'm thinking of one situation where I had a triple commission.
Yeah.
Where I had to write three completely different band pieces. And unfortunately, the commission came up at the time of my mother's death. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't call it writer's block. It was an emotional block. I just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was able to work with the person who commissioned it to postpone it for a certain amount of time. But, you know, the time got shorter and shorter. I had to get all three of the pieces done pretty much at the same time. And I never want to do that again.
Yeah.
Certainly not under those circumstances.
Right.
But I'm happy with the results of one of the pieces. The other two, not so much. Mm-hmm. So I prefer to work in a single-minded mode.
Do you find that if you do that, where you're working at multiple projects at once, that some of one piece seeps into all of them? Or I don't know. That's kind of what happens to me.
To a little extent. Maybe a phrase or something might creep in.
Right.
Yeah. But the other challenge is that if I know I have to write more than one piece at the same time, I will try to make sure that they are as different from each other as possible to begin with. Mm-hmm. So if one is slow, the other is fast. If one is traditionally tonal, maybe the other one isn't. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And my harmonic palette is broad enough, as I'm sure yours is as well, that I can separate things to that extent.
So do you mostly compose at the computer, by hand, at the keyboard, at a piano?
Yes.
all the above?
All of the above plus guitar. And even once at the mandolin, because I play that too. It depends on the piece. I do tend to write my orchestral and band pieces at the piano first. I do the initial sketches at the piano. And then either just at my desk or into Finale, because it's just faster that way.
Right. Since you teach composition, what strategies do you help young composers with in terms of a process?
Especially with the undergrads, they don't even know where to begin sometimes. And that's honest. I mean, makes perfect sense. So how do you get them started? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do, and again, it depends on the student and what they're trying to learn, what I think they need to learn, is I will generally give them a set of variations to write. I'll give them a tune. To create a set of variations. And in a sense, it's like arranging, because I refer to both as composing with someone else's ideas.
Right.
So if you write a set of variations, you're really exploring how music works, how you can manipulate it, how you can, get the most out of it. Mm-hmm. You learn aspects of development from that. And once you've done variations, that's something you can pull out of your back pocket anytime you're in a time crunch. Mm-hmm. For composing. Right. Somebody says, "Oh, I need this piece tomorrow." You go, "Oh, what do I do now?" Okay, write a set of variations. It's a very useful tool.
Well, like you said, it kind of gives you the idea of doing the maximum amount you can with the minimal amount of material.
Yeah, and you don't have to come up with your own material.
Right.
You're working with something else.
So, but even if you do, essentially that's what you're trying to do even with your own material.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And there were other things, you know, write something in ABA form or sonata form, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Using traditional forms as a starting point. And, you know, if they question it, and I hope they do, my response is usually, if you want to know what rules you're going to be breaking, you have to know how to use the rules.
Right.
And besides, there's really no such thing as rules. It's all traditions.
Well, do you find that younger composers are a little bit too bound by the computer or by the playback of the computer?
Some of them are, yeah.
Yeah, and that their creativity is limited by the...
By what the computer can do and not what they can think of.
Right, right.
And when I find that happening, I don't find it as much in the last couple of years as I used to. But when I do find that happening, I give them whatever the next assignment is going to be, I insist that they do it pencil on paper. And it's
a good lesson, yeah.
It forces them to think differently. Mm-hmm. And I say, don't do what the computer can do because, you know, the computer is ultimately stupid. Mm-hmm. It will only... Yeah.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. And nobody says that anymore, but you and I know what that means.
Yeah.
But you use pencil and paper because your creativity is unfettered. Mm-hmm. When you do it that way. If you're just doing what the computer can do, you're limiting yourself.
Right.
And they get it. They do get it.
Yeah. Well, I find sometimes too that composers get caught up in the sound of it, that they don't see the forest through the trees. For example, mm-hmm. especially with counterpoint.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, the counterpoint will sound okay with as much reverb as you can put on it. And then often I'll ask a composer, even, you know, people who submit pieces to me, say, can you send that to me as a piano sound only?
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And then they sort of sheepishly go, boy, I'm sorry, because now I hear all this bad counterpoint.
There is a man I highly respect at another publishing company. He's the editor there. And his main focus is band.
It's okay to use his name.
Oh, okay. Clarence Barber.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Clarence is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And he takes what you just said to an extreme. He refuses to listen to a Finale file or a Sibelius file that uses what's supposed to be the instrument sounds. He only wants to hear it as piano. Mm-hmm. And I get it. I totally get that.
Yeah.
And his response is, look, I can read a score. I can hear the instruments in my head. I just want to make sure that the harmonies work and the lines work, et cetera.
Right.
And that makes perfect sense to me. I don't mind using the sounds on Finale. I use it as a sort of a quasi-reality check.
Right, right.
But... sure, I hear the stuff in my head too. I can read a score just as, you know, just like you can, just like Clarence can.
For the most part, for me, it turns into I just want the sounds to play back so I can kind of get a overall feel for the arch of the piece.
Exactly. The sense of it.
Yes.
The sense of the piece.
Do the transitions work? Is it enough of this section? Is it enough contrast? You know, that's sort
mm-hmm.
of
thing.
But,
yeah, you're talking about form and how things unfold in time and all of that.
Right. And I think if you're too tied to the sounds that you don't necessarily see that as much maybe as you should.
One thing I've noticed, you know, we've been talking about how I work with students. One of the things that comes up far too often, but it will always come up, and that is and I'm talking averages now, the average beginning composition student feels compelled to put a new idea in every measure or every two measures, or just brand new idea, and has no concept of how to connect them or how to use just what you have.
Right.
That's another reason for doing the variations, because it teaches
it's one
you,
idea.
Yeah, it's one idea, and you're stuck with it. You have to work with that idea. I did a piece. I was commissioned once by the Naval Forces Europe band, one of our nation's Navy bands, stationed in Naples, Italy. Mm. They commissioned me to write a piece, and they brought me over to conduct it. And oh my, that was one of the best experiences I've ever had.
That's great.
But what am I going to write for them? That was the big question. And, you know, my comments earlier aside, I did decide to write a set of variations, but I was going to do it on my own terms. I chose a fairly well-known, but not the best-known, Tarantella. And it's a Neapolitan song, and it's called Cicerinella. And I decided to write a set of variations on it, but they're character variations. So one variation sounds like a big band. One variation sounds like Ravel's Bolero, and so on. And I just had all sorts of fun with it. I pulled out all the stops on it.
Right. That sounds really like an interesting piece that the listeners certainly should check out.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked a little bit earlier about writer's blocks, maybe not, that's something that you don't always deal with. I mean, do you have advice for younger composers who maybe do deal with that?
I rarely get writer's block, so it's a little tricky for me to answer that, but I have.
Well, why do you think that is then, that you don't?
Well, because I'm always thinking about the next thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if I get stuck, I mean, I do get stuck. Every composer gets stuck at some point. But when I do get stuck, I have several approaches to dealing with that. And one is to write something. I put that project aside for the time being, and I write something else, anything else, something simple, something more difficult, you know. I consciously try to go in a different direction just to clear my head, if nothing else.
Right.
And literally, you know, I'll take a break too. I'll just stop work altogether for an hour or a day or even a week and just walk away from the project altogether until my brain figures out subconsciously what I have to do. And then I go back to it and I look at the music and I go, oh, that's what I should be doing.
Do you think that young composers are just in a hurry? Or a lot of composers are just in a hurry? And if they get to a point where, like you said, you just don't know you're a little bit stuck, rather, I guess, than writer's block, that you're a little stuck, that I don't think they maybe see that that's just part of the process.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because they want to be in a hurry and they want to crank out the music as fast as they possibly can. When in reality, you have to let the music evolve as it was intended.
Mm-hmm. And this is part of this is actually the same coin, maybe a different side of the same coin, of the issue of trying to squeeze in as many ideas as you can.
Right, right.
What a lot of new composers don't understand is the concept of letting the music unfold in time.
Mm.
Allow it to breathe. You know, don't just put in an idea and stop and go on and put in another idea. How do we perceive what we're hearing? How do we hear it? We hear it in time, and it has to unfold at the right pace, whatever that pace may be for that music.
Mm-hmm.
So that we, as listeners, comprehend it, absorb it, internalize it, become something that evokes an emotional response. And that's what we're really after whenever we write music, no matter what kind of music we're writing. We're looking for an emotional response of some sort.
Right. Talk to us a little bit about, has your compositional process changed over the years? Obviously, it probably has because of just experience, I would think.
Mostly that.
Yeah.
Mostly that. I find I'm writing with more, what's a good word, fluidity. I'm writing more naturally. It's not as angst-ridden a process as it used to be.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, thank goodness, right?
Right.
somebody says, write that. Oh, okay. You know, I don't get worried about something. It's a funny thing. On the bigger things that I write, the longer works, like one of the symphonies or my violin concerto, anything of length and of deeper intent, shall we say, I get to a point about midway into the piece. I don't know if this happens to you, but I get about midway or so, and I start hating the piece. No matter how good it is.
Yes, I have had that experience too, yeah.
And, you know, I just hate it with a fiery passion. And that's when I know, okay, I must be at the halfway point here. Mm-hmm. And I also know that it's time to take a break from it. So I'll take a day off. I'll go to a museum or, you know, my wife and I will go out for dinner or something. And then I'll come back to it a little bit later with a clearer head, and I'm able to say, okay, you still hate it, but let's get through it. And then I get back into it and I don't hate it anymore.
I don't know if you've read the book. It's called The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The book is about the writing process for an author, but it's all the same. He calls it resistance. He said resistance tries to, you know, put everything in the way that it possibly can to stop you from, you know, doing your work.
And procrastination.
Like, yes. Yeah. His term is just, he calls it resistance. Yeah. He says the more resistance you get, the more you know that you have to finish it.
and that's why deadlines are so good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Do you find that you work better with a deadline or without?
Absolutely 100% with a deadline.
Me too.
If I have a lot of time, I take a lot of time.
The work tends to fill up the time you have to do it.
Yes. Yes.
I'm the same way.
I think that's a product of my days, which you have similar experiences with writing arrangements for some of the major publishers with pop music.
Oh, yes. Well, that's how I got started. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So you have to write that stuff fast because they want it now.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn to be fast and you learn to work on a deadline. You know, we have to have this arrangement done on Monday and they give you the materials on Friday. So you just, I learned to just, like you said, use the time that they give you to do what you need to do to get it done.
So, yep.
So yeah, I get that. Well, this is awesome. I think we could probably go on for many more hours just talking about your process, especially since you teach composition. And I might encourage people to check out studying with you because obviously you have a lot of experience and that would be fantastic.
What, if you don't mind my adding something to this.
Sure.
When I teach composition, it's not just concert music that I teach. Mm-hmm. I also teach writing for musical theater and also pop songwriting.
Composing is composing, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. But there are different factors involved when you start talking about lyrics.
Oh, that's a whole other thing.
And if you're writing for the stage, there's another set of factors that come into play.
Right.
Whether you're writing for stage or film, actually, those two are quite similar in that you're composing from more of a psychological point of view than anything else.
Yes. That does it for another episode of From the Composer. I'm Larry Clark from Excelsi Music Publishing. Thank you for listening.